the final point, the final context that I explored in terms of explaining the rise of smoking was the commercial and economic context. During the middle decades of the 19th century, a variety of pharmaceutical companies and instrument makers were developing new forms of inhaler to deliver fumes, smoke, other substances directly to the lungs. And this was important commercially, but it also resonated with widespread public concerns about respiratory diseases in this period. There were epidemics and pandemics of influenza, rising levels of morbidity and mortality from pneumonia, bronchitis, and a variety of coughs and colds that people were trying to treat. And what the commercial inhaler manufacturers managed to do was to sell this idea that you should treat them by inhalation. And there were a variety of devices and inhalers made in that period that sort of, I suppose in some ways, legitimated the idea of inhaling something, inhaling smoke, to cure a disease. So there are a variety of clinical, cultural, and commercial contexts that explain the rise of smoking in the 19th century. And you can see it very clearly, particularly, this is how I start the article, you can see it very clearly in the life of Marcel Proust, famous French writer who had very, very severe asthma from a young age. He started when he was nine and was suffered from it all his life. And in his later years, he lived in a cork-lined bedroom to keep out all the allergens and the fumes, and would then fumigate the room, would smoke, would burn stramonium powder and smoke stramonium cigarettes endlessly, just to live in this haze of stramonium smoke. And when he went out, he would smoke stramonium cigarettes all the time. And he relied almost exclusively on stramonium as a means of treating his asthma. And that sort of demonstrates both the popularity and the cultural context, but it also highlights how desperate some asthmatics were to be treated, because that was the only route he found effectively to managing his asthmatic attacks. The final third section of the paper explores what was essentially a very gradual decline of interest and support for smoking for asthma. Many physicians in the late 19th, early 20th century continued to promote smoking. I think that's the first thing to say. In fact, throughout the 20th century, you can find physicians right up to the 1970s, 80s, promoting smoking stramonium for asthma. But by and large, support for smoking stramonium began to decline. And I think, again, what the third section of the paper attempts to do is to explore the cultural, the medical, and the commercial context that happened in. I think the first explanation for the gradual decline is that during the early decades of the 20th century, a new theory of asthma emerged, the theory that asthma was an allergic condition characterized by inflammation in the airways. And the fear that many doctors had was that if it was an inflammatory condition, if you smoked, you were adding irritants to your lungs, which would increase the inflammation and make it worse. And so many allergists and many respiratory physicians began to suggest that smoking was not appropriate for asthmatics, not just smoking stramonium, but smoke generally. And to some extent, you can chart the rise of anti-smoking right back to then, and in fact into the 19th century, well before the link between smoking and cancer, because of this fear amongst allergists that smoking would exacerbate asthma. The second feature of the decline of smoking, I think, is that a number of new preparations emerged that were much better at dealing with asthma in the early 20th century. The pharmaceutical industry was growing quite rapidly during the late 19th, early 20th century, and the effect of that was to produce a whole range of new medications in the realm of asthma, particularly adrenaline, for example, which could be inhaled as well and was inhaled sometimes. The methyl xanthines derived from tea and coffee, antihistamines, eventually bronchodilators such as salbutamol in the 1960s, and then inhaled steroids such as beclomethasone in the 1970s. And the expansion of the therapeutic arsenal available to doctors and to patients tended to marginalise smoking as a means of treating asthma. And most of those treatments, adrenaline, antihistamines, bronchodilators and so forth, proved fairly effective eventually in treating asthma. I think there's also there were also, of course, from the 1950s, growing fears about the link between smoking and cancer and smoking and bronchitis, and this tended to marginalise smoking as a therapeutic approach to asthma as well. And there were a lot of fears from that period that children exposed to smoke, for example, it would worsen their asthma, and adults passively smoking, their asthma would get worse. So that second half of the 20th century in particular, the emergence of effective new therapies plus a gradual decline in smoking because of health reasons were important. I think there was also the point I make in the article is that just as smoking and smoking cannabis and opium in the 19th century had facilitated the acceptance of smoking, the gradual government regulation and the marginalisation of smoking recreational drugs also probably marginalised smoking stramonium, which could be classed as a recreational drug, as we'll see in a moment. So a variety of clinical, cultural and commercial concerns. I think the important point to make, though, that in spite of those developments, smoking stramonium for asthma did not disappear until quite late. It wasn't probably until the 1980s, 1990s, well after all the concerns about smoking and health had emerged. And the threat to smoking stramonium came from a rather strange quarter, because during the 1960s, a number of Canadian physicians had noticed that the Canadian youngsters were mashing up stramonium cigarettes, immersing them in water and then drinking it to get a high. And it goes back to very early use of stramonium. In the American Indian culture, stramonium was a hallucinogenic, was used as a recreational drug, much like henbane and other opiates. And from the 1960s, it was not just evident in Canada that Canadian youngsters were doing it, but throughout the world, youngsters were using this to get a high. And there were one or two deaths from it. There were one or two serious incidents and one or two deaths. And it was that fear about teenage drug abuse that was really the final nail in the coffin for smoking for asthma. It had survived new treatments, it had survived concerns about smoking and cancer, it had survived the sort of cultural shift in the 20th century away from smoking, particularly in the second half of the 20th century, and what finally led to its demise as a treatment was this fear about drug abuse and the use of it by youngsters to get highs. So the article finishes with this irony, in a sense, that if it hadn't been for that one or two cases of drug abuse, we probably might still be smoking for asthma.
What questions or topics for further research does the article raise?
I think there are three areas that I'd like to highlight. The first comes back to the point I made at the beginning about how we write the history of smoking, for example, and related activities. For obvious reasons, most of the emphasis historiographically has been on risk factor analysis, the emergence of the link between smoking and cancer, and the gradual regulation of smoking by governments, the restriction of smoking in public places, in hotels, in restaurants, on aeroplanes, whatever. And quite rightly, because that has been a major cause of morbidity and mortality throughout the world. But I think that there are other ways of writing history. We should not necessarily only take the sort of modern politically correct line, but open up other questions. And one of the things about smoking is that, obviously, in spite of the health concerns, many, many people smoke. Not so much in this country as they did, but you only have to go to continental Europe to see, in France and Italy, the number of people who smoke, for example, other countries as well. And the question is, why? How do we retain that cultural attachment to smoking in the face of evidence that it makes us all ill and kills us? And one of the arguments, of course, is that we get addicted. We're addicted to nicotine or whatever it might be. But I think there's another one, and that is that historically, traditionally, smoking has been used therapeutically, particularly for asthma, but also for stress. Some of the work that I'm doing at the moment on the history of stress, one of the chapters at the end of the book explores the ways in which the tobacco industry during the 1960s, 70s and 80s were deliberately looking at research linking smoking to stress relief, suggesting, some of the researchers were, that in fact the benefits of smoking for stress relief might outweigh the risk of developing chronic bronchitis or cancer later. And that's an individual choice that people have to make, I guess. But there was a very strong research and commercial interest in the therapeutic effects of smoking, and I don't think that has been explored. So part of the aim of the article was just to open up questions about how we write these kinds of histories. The second area that I think I've tried to get at, both in this article and in the book on asthma, is that we have very, very good histories of health policies. We have very good histories of public health. We have very good histories of infectious diseases. We don't have that many strong histories of chronic degenerative non-infectious diseases. And my work on asthma was an attempt to try and foreground chronic diseases, particularly in the modern world, as a major source of morbidity and mortality, and raise historical awareness of the importance of researching those subjects. The final point, I think, is that as historians we tend to focus very closely on particular historical contexts, quite rightly, because that allows analytical depth. one of the dangers of writing an article like this is that if you write it over a long period of time, then there's a tendency to be superficial and skirt over some important contextual issues. But at the same time, you open up other questions. So the article, in a sense, is making a case for more long-term studies over a long period of time, diachronic histories of diseases that open up questions about continuity and change, open up questions about shifting cultural context, fashioning medical therapeutics and behaviour, open up questions about the diagnosis of disease and the definition of disease and the experience of disease over longer periods of time. So I think I think there were three areas that I would highlight: the importance of developing a more balanced and provocative history of smoking, the importance of developing histories of chronic disease, and the importance of attempting sometimes these longer diachronic biographies of disease.